What are the latest plans on the drawing board to explore the outer solar system? We're going to talk to Andrew Shapiro. He's in charge of early development for many of the projects at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And we'll talk about the latest Bill Nye Show on Netflix, as well as the National Geographic Channel's miniseries on Albert Einstein called Genius. I'm Dave Schlom, and this is Blue Dot on North State Public Radio, coming to you from Northern California. We're all new and all blue. Join us now. Our first guest is Andrew Shapiro, Manager of Early Stage Innovation for the Space Technology Office at the California Institute of Technology Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where he's currently responsible for a potential Europa lander mission. He joins us via Skype from his office in Pasadena to talk about this and many other fascinating missions on the drawing board that may expand our scientific presence in the outer solar system. Andrew, recently NASA came out with a list of projects that are being considered of innovative technology. Could you kind of give us an overview of that list of projects?
Well, we just won a set of awards from something called the NIAC, or the NASA Innovative Advanced Concepts. And this is a call that NASA puts out that's open to any scientific organization, university, companies, and even qualified individuals, where they compete for advanced concepts. The kinds of concepts that they're looking for are ones that encourage ideas that could transform eventually into NASA missions in the long term. So things with radically or better new technology or ways of doing things, and they are looking at a wide range of sources rather than the kind of traditional NASA bidding to get these innovative concepts and to provide some studies. They just issued about 22, I believe, studies. We won 5 of those 22 through a competitive process.
Tell us about the 5.
Well, we have really 3 very interesting ones. We have a combination of what they call phase 1 and phase 2 concepts. The program is broken into these 2 phases. The phase 1s are an initial 9-month, $125,000 study. And those are to see if a concept is really even feasible or not. These are things that really haven't been tried before at all. The phase 2s, the qualification for getting a phase 2 is to have successfully completed a phase 1. They're a little more in-depth studies, which are 2 years and about $500,000, which really support teams to do much more in-depth investigation if the initial investigations pan out. So the 3 that we looked at for the phase 1, one of them is interesting. It's a dark probe, a direct probe of dark energy interactions with Solar System Laboratory. And this is an attempt to try to measure dark energy, and which is something that's been quite elusive. The physicists are still trying to figure out exactly how to measure this. And they propose to put a satellite well outside of the Earth's gravitational field to remove any influences of Earth's gravity on the interactions with the dark energy. That's a very interesting proposal by one of our senior researchers here at JPL named Nan Yu. We have 2 other phase ones that are closely related. One of them is called a breakthrough propulsion architecture for interstellar precursor missions. And what that is a particular kind of propulsion system. It's kind of a version of an ion engine that's powered photovoltaically, but instead of sun providing the photons, high-powered lasers would provide the photons. It's estimated that they could get speeds up to 40 AU per year on this, and AU is an astronomical unit, which is the distance between the Earth and the Sun. And so that's moving along pretty darn fast. That's much faster than anything that we've ever launched before.
So give me an idea how, okay, 40 AU in a year, like how, that's out to Pluto?
Yes, something like that. The Voyagers are currently at 137 AU, and they just exited the heliopause, which is kind of the end of the influence of the sun on the rest of the universe. So it's outside of our solar system. So in about 3 years, you could get to the edge of the solar system where the Voyagers are. Keep in mind that the Voyagers, it took them one more than 30 years to get to that same place.
Yeah, they were launched in 1977. So we're talking about getting something out there in just 3 years?
Yes, yes. Wow. So if this concept is successful, that would be quite a bit faster. This is a precursor mission, if you will, a precursor step to what we would look at as an interstellar mission. And there are two aspects we should look at. This first baby step would support one of our other NIAC winners, which is something called direct multiple imaging and spectroscopy of an exoplanet with a solar gravity lens mission. And these two are coupled in the following way. This last one that I just mentioned with the solar gravity lens is a really interesting concept where they actually put a telescope at something called the Oort cloud. And the Oort cloud is about 600 AU from the Earth. And the question is, why would you put a telescope at the Oort cloud? That's pretty far away. What's interesting there? Well, what this proposal, this third proposal that we're talking about, suggests is that if you put a telescope out there, it's a focal point for a gravitational lens using the sun. So photons directly opposing the sun at 600 AU on the opposite side of the sun would be focused into this point at the Oort cloud. And from that far focal point, if you back out further than that and look at any stars in that pathway, the estimate is that he could actually image exoplanets at another star on the order of 10 kilometer resolution. So think about that.
What? Wait a minute now. Okay, 10 kilometers. So you're talking about being able to look at planets like the TRAPPIST-1 system that we just heard about. You're talking about being able to get resolution where you can see something 10 kilometers across?
That is correct. So those are our three phase one winners. We have two phase two winners also. And the phase twos, this is their second year around. They've already won a phase one, successfully completed their study. Their study indicated there might be more interesting work to follow. And so let me tell you about these other two studies. One of them is called an automaton rover for extreme environments. And interestingly enough, both of these phase two studies involve the exploration of Venus. Now, Venus is a very, very extreme atmosphere. It's about 500 C ambient temperature.
So 900 degrees Fahrenheit, like hotter than a kitchen oven.
Yeah, that's like when your oven's on the clean cycle. That's pretty darn hot. That's the ambient temperature on the ground. It has a varying types of sulfuric acid or sulfur and sulfur compound in the atmosphere, but the kind of nastiest thing is think about going through a bath of sulfuric acid on the way down. And it's also at 90 bars. Keep in mind that here on Earth, we're at 3/4 of a bar in atmospheric pressure. So 90 bars is like being underwater a ways. So the record, I believe, is held by the Russians, where they've spent a couple of days transmitting data from the surface. What this brilliant gentleman named Jonathan Souter proposed was to have an entirely mechanical rover. And he based his concept on the automatons of the late 1800s, where it was a time before electricity where there was a tremendous amount of ingenious mechanical creativity, where they had all these devices that could do many, many different kinds of functions mechanically. And so he tried to take a lesson from that and come at things from a completely different angle than we normally would, and create a rover that could walk around on the surface using entirely mechanical power and mechanical abilities. No electronics at all was his goal. And I think he's going to succeed in coming up with a design that can do that. Now, there's some other minor things like being able to send a sample to the surface to from the surface to an orbiter, or being able to look at at scientific data on the surface and send it back. I think probably he'll need some small amount of electronics in order to do that. But even then, we've demonstrated a transmitter, for instance, that'll work at 500 C, and that in that kind of environment that could transmit a signal. So think if that were the only piece of electronics needed, we could conceive of this rover, instead of being walking around for a couple of days at the most, this could walk around for months collecting scientific data and returning it to us.
You are listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. I'm Dave Schlom. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Andrew Shapiro from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And coming up later in the show, we'll talk about the latest Netflix series featuring Bill Nye, as well as Genius on National Geographic Channel. Stay with us. We're back talking about future NASA robotic missions to the outer solar system and new technologies being developed with Andrew Shapiro from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena.
It's amazing to think about trying to design something for such an extreme environment as what Venus is like.
Well, we spend a lot of time thinking about that. Not only Venus, but we have the other extremes as well. I don't know if you're interested in talking a little bit about some of our other extreme environment projects.
Certainly.
One of them is that's a proposal that's on the table. It's not an official mission yet. Is we have the potential of a mission to Europa.
Well, and nobody's interested in Europa, are they?
There might be a few people.
Yeah, because it's the ocean world out at Jupiter that is probably, perhaps, the most likely place to harbor living organisms in its oceans.
That's entirely correct. And so we're looking at some of the issues on how you might approach that. So Europa's got some interesting challenges on its own. It's at a 100 Kelvin ambient temperature. So what's that? That's minus 170 C. It's darn cold. And in addition to that, it has no atmosphere whatsoever. So the kinds of traditional thermal methods that we use for heating or cooling things aren't necessarily going to work very well there either. In addition to that, the Jupiter radiation field is extremely high at the particular orbit of Europa. So it's continuously being bombarded by fairly severe radiation. And that gets trapped in the in Europa's field as well. So there's a tremendous amount of difficulty in terms of the extreme environments there. The hardest part with the extreme cold like this is that batteries don't work at that temperature. So I don't know if you've ever tried to use your cell phone when you're out on a ski slope, but if you take it out and have it out of your hand for more than a few minutes, it starts to see the ambient temperature. When it's blowing cold, the battery just stops working. The coldest we can get a battery to really operate in any reasonable kind of method is about minus 40 Celsius. And that's a particularly specialized battery. And that's really difficult to do on its own. And here we're talking at least 140 degrees Celsius below that. And so that's an interesting challenge. So the current design that we're looking at uses half of the batteries on the payload to warm the rest of the spacecraft in order for it to function. So the power limitations are extreme in this kind of environment. Then the other challenge, as you pointed out, Europa is an ocean world. And as we try to explore these ocean worlds, we want to actually get to the water where there might be life. And getting to the water is incredibly difficult because, depending on the scientist you talk to, there may be something between 5 and 30 kilometers of ice between the surface and the ocean itself.
So how do you get the craft from the surface through all of that ice?
That's a great question. And that's what we're working on now. So the first mission won't do that. The first mission will go there and explore the environment and try to figure out how to operate in the environment. The team that I'm working with in the Space Technology Office at JPL is working on what would it look like for the second mission, which is after we've explored the environment for a few months, we've been able to take some measurements of the surface, understand the kind of ice that we're looking at, because there are a lot of issues about understanding the properties of the material that we'd actually be going through. And then we're actually entertaining a number of competing proposals on how to get through the ice right now. In fact, this morning and for the next few weeks, we're doing a study looking at how to do the system trade-offs for these different competing ways of getting through the ice.
And what are some of those ways of trying to get through the ice?
Well, it's an interesting question. You could drill through the ice, for instance, with a drill or perhaps a percussive drill of some kind. You could use a saw blade. You could try to melt the ice with lasers. You could try to melt the ice with a nuclear source. There are a lot of different ways that people are trying to get there. One proposal was looking at possibly a chemical reaction that would create heat, an exothermic reaction that would create heat and melt ice as you go down. The difficulty, of course, is that at the surface, it's still 100 Kelvin, and so the ice would pretty quickly refreeze behind you as you start to traverse your way down through the ice block.
And by nuclear, what you mean is like using nuclear isotopes for their decay to generate heat, not using
them
to...
Yes, very much like we've been using on the Mars rovers, the current Mars rover, not the previous generation, but the current Mars rover, which does use a nuclear source to power it and move it around the surface of Mars. And that's a heat generator. It just uses essentially the thermal decay to generate heat, as you mentioned. And that's a sustained heat source. There are some real concerns with a group of people that we have to work with at NASA and globally, actually, called Planetary Protection. Mm-hmm. And that creates some limitations on the kinds of things that we can do. We don't want to create a situation where we're dumping nuclear waste of some kind into another planet without it being protected well, or creating new kinds of habitats that weren't there before. Or particularly, we don't want to bring microbes or any kind of life, viruses, whatever you might call life, with us and then discover that later as the life on a different planet.
Yes, you don't want to contaminate what could be the only other place in the solar system that has life.
Yes, so we need to be extremely careful about that. And so we're trying to navigate that whole scientific direction in terms of how do we make sure that we haven't done any contamination and yet we can get through the ice to find the potential life that might be there.
And it's an ethical issue too.
Oh, absolutely. And we very much do not want to create any kind of issue on another planet as best we understand it.
Well, it's interesting talking to you about this because it was 21 years ago, about now, that I sat in the same restaurant that I sat in about an hour ago talking to Dr. Eugene Shoemaker And he first told me about his idea for having a probe melt its way through the ice of Europa to go investigate the oceans down there, take cameras on a mini submarine, turn on the lights, and see what's down there.
And we're still making small steps. I think we're a few steps closer to that pathway than we were 20 years ago. I think we're actually starting to really get into depth on some of the technical issues that are need to be resolved in order for us to get there.
With proper funding, depending on the NASA budget, how long do you think it would be before we could see some of these missions to Europa?
Well, the Europa Clipper mission, which is the large orbiter that's going to be going around Jupiter, is scheduled to launch in, I believe, 2023. And if we're successful, we would have a ride-along mission of some kind with the first lander to kind of observe the ambient environment there and understand what we're trying to work our way through. That takes us to about 2030. Once we're there, then we probably would start working on what the next mission would be to get through the ice. So we would probably look at something like, potentially a 2030 launch, something like that, in order to get there. So by 2035 would be a likely time frame if everything were to go well. And a lot of that also has to do with the scientific community's input. There are a lot of people at the National Academy that are studying this problem and who have significant opinions about what should be studied next and when, and should it, should the next mission go to Titan rather than a second one to Europa? And so all of those issues would have to be resolved.
Well, Dr. Andrew Shapiro, we're about out of time, but thank you for sharing all these fascinating, futuristic, and technologically innovative ideas with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thanks to Andrew Shapiro. He joined us from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Now let's shift gears and talk about science on both the streaming service Netflix and the cable channel National Geographic. Nolan Ford joins me to talk about Bill Nye Saves the World, a half-hour series on Netflix, and Genius, a miniseries biopic of the life and work of Albert Einstein starring Jeffrey Rush.
So, Dave, what did you think when you first heard that Bill Nye was going to have a new show on Netflix?
Well, I was excited because, I loved watching Bill Nye the Science Guy with my kids back in the 90s. I was kind of a young parent when that show was popular. So it was great to watch with kids. And as a school teacher, it was, one of those things, if you weren't feeling well or you were going to be absent, you could always leave Bill Nye the Science Guy episodes for your substitute teacher to show and know that they were going to get some good content. So I was very excited about it. So what did you think?
Well, a lot of the people that I know, online have been talking about it, but some concerns people had were they thought that they didn't like the studio audience. They thought that seemed kind of forced.
It made it seem a bit like, watching The Daily Show or something like that you would see on Comedy Central, didn't it?
Yeah. It's interesting because, Bill Nye is known for making science accessible for little kids, but then this show is for adults or, as he refers to people as big kids. So it's kind of funny how he's talking to adults, but he's still trying to make everything like really simple and understandable. And one thing I personally really liked about it is how they have so many different sections to the show. So it's constantly engaging you with different segments. Either it's a panel of people talking about climate change or a remote piece when they're talking about things that people are doing in Italy about climate change. So I like that it never gets boring. So that's good.
I particularly enjoyed two of the correspondents. I really like Derek Muller, who is on YouTube, famous for his Veritasium channel on YouTube. I really enjoy him. I think he's very engaging. He's really good at explaining things and making things interesting. So I enjoyed his pieces very much. I also really liked Emily Calandrelli. She was awesome. I thought she's a kind of a astrophysics space person. So she was very well featured in that too. So I liked some of the young correspondents they were using.
Well, in addition to the correspondents, what else did you like about it? And what did you find disappointing?
Well, some of it seemed a bit contrived, you know, when they do the fist bump thing and, you know, fist bump, blow it up is just kind of like, okay, you're trying to show that you're hip with the young people. After a while, that got a little bit stale with me. That's just a little thing. Overall, I liked it. I thought it was fun and engaging to watch. And I think it's one of those shows that, you know, it's just their first season and I hope they'll get to do some more. I think it's one of those things where it takes a while to find your stride with a show like that. And given some time, I think it could get better and better. I do think, you know, now's the time to have a show like that where you have somebody talking about the scientific method and, you know, where you use facts and you use evidence and you use data to explain things instead of just anecdotal stories. Well, this worked for me, so, you know, I must be true. A lot of the stuff about like alternative medicine and even his take on GMOs, you know, he changed his mind on those. And that's a pretty controversial subject. But at least he comes at it with, you know, that objective lens of science, which I think is something we really need right now.
Let's switch gears and talk about another show that I know you watched, the Albert Einstein biopic series Genius. What did you think about that?
I really enjoyed that. That was a really pleasant surprise. Jeffrey Rush plays the adult Albert Einstein. And adult is a key word. I mean, the show starts off right off the bat with showing him pretty explicitly having sexual relations with his secretary in later in life. And he was a person with a pretty complicated moral compass, if I could put it that way, and had a lot of affairs. And that's something that, you know, most people that know a little bit about Albert Einstein don't know that side of him at all. They just think of him as that wild, frizzy-haired old guy with the mustache riding a bicycle or sticking his tongue out when he was later in life and not the young man who, you know, was full of passions of all kinds. I thought it really does a great job of explaining what his early life was like and how complicated the forces were that he was dealing with in Germany, especially growing up with anti-Semitism and his father's business folding and then the family moving away to Italy and him wanting to join them, but the father not wanting that, wanting him to stay in school. There was a lot of conflict. It really does a great job of showing the complex emotional side of Albert Einstein's youth growing up and, you know, what that was like for him. So it's really a biopic in the sense of a motion picture more so than a documentary kind of a thing. And I really liked it.
Okay, well, now it's time for the Blue Dot Science Couch Potato Review. How many blue dots for Bill Nye's Save the World?
I'd give Bill Nye Saves the World 2.5 dots. It's a solid effort. It has some things that I don't care for in it. But, you know, if young people like it, that's the target audience, not me. I still think it has room to grow. And I think, you know, given time, I think the show will get better and better. I'd like to see a little tighter writing, better jokes. It's not as funny as it wants to be.
And how about Genius?
Genius, I have four dots, a solid four dots. It's well worth sitting down and watching. Thanks again to Andrew Shapiro and Nolan for his take on Bill Nye Saves the World. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow us on Twitter at NSPRNews or me at Dave Shlom. For fellow couch potato Nolan Ford, I remind you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.